By evening, the fever had passed, and Manatasi lay exhausted, but naturally asleep. Hui stood over him smiling and nodding happily. He felt that he'd won this wasted giant, wrested him from death's dark jaws with prayer and endeavour. He experienced a proud warmth of ownership, and when the old slave crone brought him a brimming bowl of good Zheng wine, Hui lifted it in a salute to the sleeping giant. "The gods have given you to me. You are mine. You live under my protection now, and I pledge it to you." And he drained the bowl. The weakness of his body smothered him, pressing him down on the hard mattress of straw. It was an effort to lift head or hand, and he hated his body that had failed him now. He rolled his head slowly and opened his eyes. Across the tent, on a mat of woven reeds, sat the strange little man. Manatasi watched him with a quick flaring of interest. He was stooped over a roll of the strange glowing metal that had been beaten out into thin, pliable lengths, and with a pointed knife, he was scratching and cutting marks into the soft surface. He spent many hours of each day at this unusual activity. Manatasi watched him, noticing the quick, nervous, bird-like movements of head and hands that set the golden earrings jangling and the thick black plaits of hair dangling down his back. The head seemed too large for the oddly hunched body, and the legs and arms were long and thick and brutal-looking. Dark hair grew on the forearms and the back of the long, tapered hands. And Manatasi remembered the speed and strength of that body in battle. He lifted his head slightly and glanced down at the linen bandages which swathed his lower body. At the movement, Hui was on his feet in one swift movement, and he came to the pallet and stooped over him, smiling. Hui said, "You sleep like a breastfed baby." And Manatasi looked up at him, wondering that a man could speak such a deadly insult to the paramount king of Vendi, and smile as he said it. "Aya, bring food," Hui shouted for the old slave woman, and settled down on a cushion beside Manatasi's couch. While Manatasi ate with huge appetite, he listened with only a small part of his attention to a ridiculous description of the moon as a white-faced woman. He wondered that such a skilled warrior could be so naive. It was only necessary to look at the moon to see that it was a cake of ground corn. And as the Mitasi Mitasi, the one great god, devoured it, so the shape of his bite could clearly be seen cut from the round cake. "Do you understand this?" Hui asked with deep concern. And Manatasi answered readily, "I understand, Highborn." "You believe it?" Hui insisted. "I believe it." Manatasi gave the answer which he knew would please, and Hui nodded happily. His efforts to teach the slave king were most rewarding. He had explained the theory of symbolic representation very carefully, showing Manatasi that the moon was not Astarte, but her symbol, her coin, her sign, and her promise. He had explained the waning and waxing as the symbolic subjugation of the female to the male, repeated in the human female by the periodic moon sickness. "Now, the great god Baal," Hui said. And Manatasi sighed inwardly. He knew what was coming. This strange person would now talk about the hole in the sky through which Mitasi Mitasi made his entrance and exits. He would try to make Manatasi believe that this was a man with a flowing red beard. What a contradictory people they were, these pale, ghost-like beings. On the one hand, they had weapons and clothes and wonderful possessions and almost magical skills in civil and military matters. He had seen them fight and work, and it had amazed him. And yet these same people could not recognize truths that even the unweaned infants of his tribe understood completely. Manatasi's first conscious thoughts when he'd emerged from the hot mists of fever had been of escape. But now, forced by his weakness into the role of observer, he had time to reconstruct his plans. He was safe here. This hunchbacked mannequin wielded some strange power, and he was under its protection. He knew this now. No one would touch him as long as his new master held his shield over him. The other thing he knew was that there was much to learn here. If he could acquire the skills and knowledge of this people, he would be armed 1,000 times. He would be the greatest war chief the tribes had ever known. They had used these skills to defeat him. He would defeat them with the same skills that he learned from them. "Do you understand?" Hui asked earnestly. "Do you understand that Baal is the master of the whole of heaven and earth?"
"I understand," said Manatasi.
"Do you accept Astarte and Great Baal as gods?"
"I accept them," Manatasi agreed.
And Hui looked very pleased. "They've placed their mark upon you. It's right that you should be dedicated to their service. When we reach the city, I will perform the ceremony in the Temple of Great Baal. I've chosen a god name for you. You will no longer use the old style."
"As you wish, Highborn."
"From henceforth, you will be called Timon."
"Timon. Timon."
The slave king tested the sound of it. "He was a priest warrior in the reign of the fifth Grey Lion. A great man." Timon nodded, not understanding, but content to watch and wait and learn.
"Highborn," he asked softly, "the marks you scratch upon the yellow metal, what are they?"
Hui jumped up and fetched the golden scroll to the couch. "This is how we store words and stories and ideas." And he plunged into an explanation of the writing process, and was rewarded by Timon's quick grasp of the principle of the phonetic alphabet. On a scrap of leather, he wrote Timon's name in sooty black ink, and in unison they spelt it out aloud. Timon laughing delightedly at his first achievement.
"Yes," he thought, "there is much to learn here, and so little time."
Across the clay box, Caius Terentius Varro, consul of Rome, fought once more, pressing his legions into Hannibal's soft centre. The centre gave with the sucky reluctance of dough, and the Spaniards and Gauls there withdrew at Hannibal's design. "Do you see it, Timon? The beauty of it? The sheer genius of it?" Hui called excitedly, speaking in Punic now, and manipulating the counters.
"And where was Marhabal now?"
Timon demanded, as excitedly, in the same language. After 2 years, his Punic was fluent, with only the dragging vowels marring its perfection. "He was here," Hui touched the cavalry counters, holding his horse on a short rein. Timon understood a horse to be a swift animal like a zebra, on whose back armed men rode.
"Varro is entangled now?"
Timon asked. "Yes, oh yes. Hannibal has crumpled his front up and enveloped him." "And then what does he do, Timon?"
"The reserves,"
Timon guessed. "Yes, you have it. The Numidians and African reserves." Hui was hopping up and down in his agitation. With the timing of the great master, he unleashes them, taking Varro in the flanks, squeezing him in a vice, packing his ranks so they can't maneuver nor wield their weapons. "And then what? Timon, what then?"
"The cavalry."
"Ah, the cavalry. Marhabal, the faithful brother, the master of horse, who has waited all that long day." "Go," cries Hannibal, and Hui threw his arm in a wide gesture. "Go, my brother, ride with your wild Iberians." "They crash into them, Timon. It is the moment, the exact moment. 5 minutes earlier is too soon, and 5 minutes later, and is too late. Timing, timing. The talent of the great military commander is timing. Of the statesman, the lover, the businessman, the merchant. The right action at the right time."
and the result highborn. What was the result? Timon pleaded in an agony of suspense. Was it victory?
Victory? Huey asked.
Yes, Timon, it was victory. Victory and massacre. 8 legions of vaunting Rome wiped out to the man. 2 entire consular armies. 8 legions, highborn. Timon marveled. 48,000 men in a single battle.
More than that, Timon. The auxiliaries were lost also. 60,000 men.
Huey swept his hand across the board, exterminating the Roman legions.
We won the battles, Timon.
But they won the wars. 3 of them. 3 bloody wars that crushed us.
Huey broke off, his voice choking. He turned away quickly and went to the water jug.
Timon hurried across and held the basin for him, while Huey washed his hands and combed his beard.
Well, that brings us to the end of our study of Hannibal's campaigns, Timon. I kept the Battle of Cannae for the last.
Who will we study next, Highborn?
The one who Hannibal himself rated, the most skillful general of all history.
And who was that?
Alexander III, Huey said, King of Macedonia, who smashed the Persian Empire, whom the oracle at Delphi proclaimed invincible, and men called the Great.
Timon held Huey's cloak for him, and Huey fastened the clasp as he left the precincts of the Temple College through the small gate in the inner wall. Timon followed a pace behind him, wearing the short blue tunic of Huey's household, with a light gold chain, a dagger and purse belting his waist, the mark of high trust as a body slave. He walked a pace behind Huey's left shoulder, so as not to mask his master's sword arm, and he kept his hand on the dagger.
Highborn, the manner in which Hannibal invested Varro.
Yes, Huey encouraged him.
Could he not have advanced his flanks and held his centre firm?
Ah, it's the difference between defence and offence, Huey explained. And they plunged into discussion of battle tactics and strategy until they left the main gate in the outer wall of the temple area. From here, any conversation was impossible, for the crowds spotted this strange couple. Giant black slave and diminutive gnome-like master. They cheered Huey, crowding around him to touch his arm in greeting, to listen to his banter, and perhaps receive an alms coin from the purse on Timon's belt. Huey loved his popularity. He smiled and joked and pushed his way gently through the press. A successful general, there'd been 2 other campaigns since the great slave-taking, a well-beloved priest, a noted wit and songwriter, and a rich philanthropist, Huey's investments had prospered exceedingly in the last 2 years. Thus he was the object of popular adulation throughout the city. They crossed the marketplace with its fascinating smells and sights and sounds of hides and humanity, of spices and open sewers. On one of the slave blocks was a light-skinned girl of mixed Yui blood, and the auctioneer spotted Huey in the crowd and called out to him,
"My lord, a work of art for you, a statue in yellow ivory,"
opening the girl's cloak to display her body. Huey laughed and waved a hand in refusal. They moved along the stern jetty at the lakeside where the ships lay with stern almost touching stern, their hatches open and the boiling of stevedores running over them, loading and unloading the merchandise. From the taverns and wine shops flanking the jetty came the sour stench of cheap wine and gusts of drunken laughter. The street girls beckoned from the narrow lanes between the shops. The uncertain light of dusk softened their raddled features and hectic painted cheeks and lips. Huey wondered what solace a man could find with the likes of them. Beyond the bustle of the harbour area lay the townhouses of the noble families and rich merchants, each protected by the high mud outer wall and the heavy carved wooden gate. Huey's new residence was one of the least pretentious of these, with the entrance off a narrow walled lane, and a view from the flat roof over the lake. Once through the gate, Hui shed his sword and cloak and handed them to Timon, with a sigh of pleasure at the moment of homecoming, and he went through into the paved central courtyard. The princes and princesses were waiting for him, 14 of them, headed by the twins, Helanka and Emilki. The two of them had grown in the past year, and they were stranded now in that awkward period between girlhood and womanhood. Too young to giggle, yet too old to greet Hui with a kiss. There were no such inhibitions upon the younger members of the House Barker, and they swarmed forward to engulf Hui. The religious instruction of the children of the royal house was the duty Hui had imposed upon himself, and despite the estrangement between king and priest, Lannan had not interfered with this arrangement. He had not sanctioned it, but he had not forbidden it. Hui led his students through into the airy living room of the house. In the courtyard, one of the royal nursemaids waited until her charges had followed the priest before she turned and her eyes sought those of Timon. She was a tall girl, with strong shoulders, long-waisted, and with fruitful hips. Her legs also were straight and strong, but her hands were narrow and pink-palmed and delicately shaped. She wore her hair oiled and dressed in the manner of the Vendi, for she was of Timon's tribe. Taken in the great raid, she was not slave-born, not of the humble, dependent breed that had known nothing but captivity. There was a fierce spirit in her to match Timon's. Her skin was a shade lighter than his. Her face was round, moon-shaped, her nose flat and broad, her lips full and pouting. But her teeth were small and even, and very white when she smiled at Timon.